This is it, you're the guy. All right, I'm Sandra Dodd, and I've come here to talk about unschooling. I only ever talk about unschooling, so no matter what the talk is called, it ends up being about the same thing, which is not to say that I repeat myself three times, because I've found that even if I use the same notes from another talk, I never tell the same stories. If I tried to do it again twice, I couldn't do it. And I'm sorry I'm so short. Today I wish I were tall because the podium is huge, but I need it for my notes. So I know I look small, but sorry. I'm not very photogenic, so if you want a picture taken with me, it's probably better to have a picture taken with somebody cute. There are tons of teenagers here. But unschooling is something that if I look back, I see that I was preparing for my unseen future since I was about six. But it's that sort of 20/20 hindsight, but I look back and see all of the ways in which I already knew that I was interested in school, teaching, learning, books, words, and it all became me. You know what I mean? It all led up to this. When I was in first grade, I loved my first grade teacher and I wanted to be her. And one thing led to another, and I never was her, but it was a direction. It was a way that even when I was little, I was deciding to do the thing that was more toward teaching when I was making decisions. So I'm going to tell you some stories about me and some stories about unschooling, and that'll lead up to some things that you can use at your house. I think that's kind of the general outline, and if I veer off of it, you won't know because you can't see my notes, thank goodness. I have one more announcement. In the next room, in the front table where Pam Sarushian is, I have a book for sale and thinking sticks. The thinking sticks have gradually evolved out of a little visual aid for a talk I gave on cognition and thinking one time. And Pam wanted to keep the sticks, so I made another set for me, and then someone else wanted one. So I kept making more sets for people, and now it has a two-page instructions flyer, which is really probably the fun part. And a little set of warnings, dire warnings, which I stole from some aspirin and, you know, drug warnings and messed with those. Because that's what I do, a lot of it's writing, but it's a toy and it's kind of a tool. So if you're new to this idea, then it's a way to loosen your thinking up. And it's hard to describe, but it might be something you want to get if you're deciding what kinds of things to buy. If you're going to tend toward natural learning, you don't need to spend a lot of money on academic books. And the book that I have out there is Essays About My Kids. They're in the order that they were written. Most were published at least in a regional newsletter somewhere. I'm very popular in British Columbia. There are a few newsletters that have published a lot of my things, and I used to have a column in Home Education Magazine. So those are collected, and they have photos. So that's one thing they didn't have on the first pass. Photos of my family. I am 54. I was born in 1953. So I experienced all the glory of the baby boom and the wild 60s. And I waited to have children until I was in my 30s, as a lot of people my age did. And my oldest is now 21. I have an 18-year-old boy named Marty, who isn't here, and a 15-year-old named Holly. When I first started homeschooling, Holly was just not born. I was pregnant with Holly. And it's interesting sometimes in online discussions or even at conferences a couple of times, people have said, well, you wouldn't really understand my problems because I have little children and yours are all older. And I'm going, look, you know, you don't get kids who are 15, 17, and 21 without having at one time had some who are 1 and 3 and 5, I think, you know. But math isn't my main thing, so I don't usually argue math. When I was... I need to apologize not only to the people here, but anyone who's listening to this recording. I've just almost recovered from the home version of pneumonia, and I just finished my second round of antibiotics, so I'm trying not to cough. But I'm glad I'm here because another speaker got sick first and aced me out of that possibility. I'm really glad to be here. This is my fourth time at this conference, and I'm very happy that they invited me back. I like this place. I like the people here. It doesn't make me want to move to California, but it almost does every time. I always get the feeling, and I think, do I know? I get home, and I'm like, New Mexico. But you tempt me. So when I was a little kid, I was interested in education. And when I was young, and they always ask you, you know, older relatives and teachers and everything, what are you going to be when you grow up? And I went through three things, and they sort of cycled. I wasn't particular about them. I figured it would be one of them. And those three things were to be a teacher, a missionary, or a magazine author, you know, a columnist, or to have articles in magazines. And I kind of do all of that. I just don't get paid. I get paid like a missionary, and and I am kind of a teacher, and I'm kind of an author. So, I guess. Then I'm successful. I never said I want to make a lot of money, so I didn't fail there. Good thing. When I was a kid, I remember really liking my fourth grade teacher, too. She liked me. And she gave me books for Christmas. We drew names for a Christmas gift. It was supposed to have a 50-cent limit or something, which in those days was actually money, probably like $3 now, you know, big bucks. And I bought a gyroscope for whoever I was buying something for, and that was high-tech in the 60s. And my teacher bought me a book on the human body and one on the moon. I was thrilled. And they didn't cost 50 cents either, you know, that she spent money. And they were hardbound, and they were really pretty. And I was so excited that I got two books, and the other kids all went, "Oh, the teacher got your name, and she gave you books." But that was okay. I still have those books. When Holly was 9, we went to a funeral of my friend's dad, and I knew she would be there, and I took those books. And I introduced her to Holly, and I said, "Look, I still have the books you gave me when I was 9, and here's Holly, and she's 9." And that was kind of cool for me. So even though I didn't ever put my kids in school, or they never chose to go to school, although Holly considered it for a year and decided not to, even though I didn't involve myself in school as an adult after I quit teaching, I still really have fond memories of my own time in school. It was better than being at home for me in my situation. And so it appealed to me, the idea that someone who was enthusiastic about something and liked things would be nice to little kids and help them like things. And so that's what school seemed like to me. I know it doesn't seem like that to everyone. I'm not saying that's how school is. I'm saying that's how my life was school. When I went to college, I didn't want to major in education because there was a huge stigma. It may still be, but at that college there was a huge stigma. Education was for people who weren't very bright. And so I majored in English, minored in psychology, ended up with a minor in anthropology, and the way getting a certificate in education worked in New Mexico, may still, is it was like having a minor. But I couldn't even say I'm minoring in education because it was too shameful. So my third minor was education. And I would sort of hide out. You know, I would try to go incognito over to the College of Education because it was such a shame. And I still kind of feel like that sometimes. What people do to get master's degrees and PhDs in education sometimes is a shocker to me. It's like they find some correlation and write a report. And the correlations are usually designed to prove that school is absolutely necessary to anyone's life and function. But anyway, I'm ahead of myself. So back to the 1970 wild days of the reform of education, they made us read John Holt. So I'm sitting in a classroom having paid money for somebody to make me read John Holt. That's cute, huh? But I read it and I believed it. And we read other school reformers. And the people who were the professors then, it was that whole hippie crowd of the schools have to be reformed or they're just going to implode upon themselves and no one's learning there and it's messing up society. And I think they were right. But what happened is when in Albuquerque, they spent a lot of city money, a lot of the school district money on the open classroom, which was kind of shorthand for the whole idea that you shouldn't just learn from books and handouts and workbooks. You should really see real things and you should touch real things, and they shouldn't make kids sit in rows to learn. They should be able to move around, and you should get them out of the room when you can. And if one kid really likes science, let him do more science. He can study other things. He can learn other things while he's doing science. So all of those principles were written about and tried and experimented with in the public schools and in the lab schools by the reformers. And it seemed like it would have worked. I mean, in theory it worked, in experiment it worked, and then in a public school setting, in the real situation, it didn't seem to work. Sometimes it didn't work because the teacher didn't get it, and the teacher was being made to do something that she didn't want to do. Sometimes it didn't work because the parents didn't like it and they put pressure on them to just line the kids up and make them do work. But sometimes it didn't work because the kids didn't want it to work. They weren't interested in, you know, as soon as someone said experimental, they said, I'm not a rat. And so they resented the fact that someone was experimenting on them or that they were doing something that they were just going to take away. You see that sometimes with kids. If you say, you want to do this really cool thing? No, not if I'm not going to get to do it forever. If it's just for now and you're going to take it away, I don't want anything to do with it. But I think, looking back and reading things that I've read since and seeing how some of the schools work that did succeed and survive, the very few little private schools that still use those methods, it doesn't work if the child has no choice but to be there. So if the children are there by compulsion, and if the teachers are told how to do it and what to do, the joy just kind of falls out of the room. You know, that's it. They're not there by choice, and they haven't chosen to do a cool thing. A cool thing has been imposed upon them by which it can't be cool anymore. And I think that might have been what did it. But there are a couple of schools in Albuquerque that are still, they were physically built for open classroom. And there's one, it's a nice building. From the outside, looks like a six-sided sort of wedge with a cool big roof. There are two of those. One was the library, and the other was six classrooms. But not really six classrooms, but six interest centers. And so one was to have all of the science equipment, one was to have all the books and little soft places to sit and to read them, so you didn't have to sit in a chair to read a book. You could get in a bed or up on a hammock or up in a little fake tree house, you know, that sort of thing. And there was going to be a math lab. And so the idea was the kids would have a checklist, but not by the day, kind of by the year, so that by the end of the year they should have done some number of hours involving history and some number of hours of each subject. And if they wanted to binge on something for a while, that was fine. But within a couple of years, the whole plan wasn't working, and so they still have those buildings. They didn't ever build permanent walls. They just kind of lined up a bunch of filing cabinets and bookcases between them. So the teachers who are in those buildings are not thrilled about it because they're using traditional methods where it would be good to have walls so that you don't have to hear anybody else's noise. So it's kind of sad to see the physical evidence of the attempt and the frustration remaining from the failure. When I had Kirby, I hadn't been teaching. I'd already quit teaching for a while. And before that, before I had Kirby, I had been working for the SCA. Until I ever came to this conference, the only reason I had ever been to this part of California at all was for a board meeting of the Society for Creative Anachronism when they made me president years ago. And then we used to meet in Berkeley and in Milpitas. But the first meeting was in Sacramento at a science fiction convention or something. Like they were in the hotel anyway, so they figured they should have a board meeting. And when I was working for the SCA, there was a lawsuit from a former board member who was just miffed about some personal stuff, and he had a friend who was a lawyer who wanted his name on a case, you know, Joe, whatever his name was, versus the SCA. The basis of their lawsuit was that the SCA wasn't an educational organization because we didn't hold classes. And so even then, I guess with my alternative ed background and with my SCA background, I said, are you crazy? You know, you're making armor and gambesons. You, the guy who was pulling the lawsuit. I said, you have learned to do these things from other people who helped you freely to learn those things. You have a market to sell them. You have opportunity to use them, really actually physically use this stuff so that you're learning more about how it needs to be made and how it needs to function. Where are you going to get that in a classroom? You know, who is going to teach you to make armor and let you put it on and they'll hit you with it? It was something. And, you know, he said, no, unless people are sitting in desks with clipboards, it's not going to look like education. I said, well, that's kind of like your problem, isn't it? But I was able to make an argument that shushed them, and it was the thing was dismissed, not just on my argument on it just being silly, but partly my argument. We were prepared. If it had gone to court, we were just going to kick his butt. So I had already thought through that, too, about how adults, for fun, will go and learn a lot of things, just for fun, even though it costs them a lot of money, even though it's a lot of work, and they have to sometimes dedicate a whole garage, a room, a van. You know, they need stuff for these big hobbies. But you see it in more expensive hobbies, skiing or stock car racing, where people will put thousands and thousands of dollars into something that risks them getting their head broken open, and they're thrilled to do it. So those are learning situations. If someone learns to restore cars, You see that in adults. We see it in adults. And we, if you're at all nervous about whether kids can learn, look at how adults learn. Look around you at your friends, and that will help. I might get back to that. So then Kirby was born, and I went to La Leche League, but I wasn't thinking anything about homeschooling at all. And in fact, I had talked to my cousin. My parents raised a cousin my age, and when I was just about to graduate from college and go teach, she had a baby. And when I had been teaching a few years and he was 3 or 4, she said, "I don't think I'm going to send Paul to school." And I talked her out of it easily, handily, talked her out of homeschooling. And I mean, I just, you know, two moves and she was down, boom, checkmate. And so I felt good about that for a while. So when Kirby was 4, he liked the idea of going to classes, and so he was in an art class and he was in a dance class, but neither one of them went well. And they didn't go badly in the same way. So it wasn't like a thing about Kirby, it was a thing about the combination of Kirby and structured learning, and it didn't work well. The art teacher liked him lots and started doing one-on-one stuff with him, but he was no good in the group. And the dance teacher just made him cry. I mean, anything she did or tried to do to fix it, he'd just cry. And he had so wanted to dance. And he had told everybody, "I'm going to a dance class, I'm going to a dance class." And so I thought, well, he's just maybe too young. He needs to not go to school yet. I was in a playgroup and a babysitting co-op with other families. And we didn't figure he was never going to go to school. We figured we were going to wait a year, that's all, until he was older and could get along with other people better. If you meet him this weekend, you might notice he gets along with people fine. So I just want to point that out. It wasn't a permanent condition. And so the group I was in had 4 homeschooling families out of about 12 families. And 2 of them did structure. 2 were unschooling families. And what I noticed more than anything is that in the unschooling families, the kids liked the parents. Sometimes when we were at the park playing, they would just go and climb up in their parents' laps. And the homeschooled kids who were doing the structure would hide from their parents and fib to their parents because they would get in trouble and get grounded. And one little girl had to sit in the car while the other kids were playing one day. And it was summer and it was hot. She's sitting in the car crying, trying to do her math homework so she can get out of the car. And the whole purpose of going to the park was not as a tool to make kids do math homework. So I wasn't a homeschooler, but I was seeing the bad effects of school at home. I was seeing the good effects of unschooling. So when we thought we would try the first year with Kirby and see how that goes, all we needed was this 1 year to stall. So what I did was I registered for kindergarten homeschool. Although in the state, I don't know how it is in California, but there, if you want to wait a year, you can. You can just say, "I don't think my kid's ready. Give us a year." So I basically went that way, and I figured, okay, if we register to homeschool, at the end of this year, he can either go into first or kindergarten, either one. No problem if he wants to do kindergarten. But of course, within a couple of months, we weren't worried about it anymore. So that plan didn't last a year. The what will we do next year just went by. Before I forget, there are some little piles of paper. I don't know if they're enough for everyone here, but there are certificates of empowerment. There's a little pile there. Could you pass those back, please? If you didn't get one, I'd love to let you have one. I hope they're enough. And there's more on chairs in the back row. Sorry about the thump. So we never did do structured homeschooling. And part of the reason is that it was kindergarten. And part of the reason is that we'd seen 2 unschooling families. I subscribed to Growing Without Schooling, which was about the only way we could get any information in those days. You had to wait 2 months. It was an all black and white thing, mostly words, very few photos. And I would read it from cover to cover, including the editorial notes and the publisher's notes, you know, the notes for the post office about whether it was second class or what, and the return address. And I'd read some of it again, and then I would start waiting 2 months. So I'm really glad to be part of the information flow that's out there. If you go online, or if you come to a conference like this, you can get more information in 3 days than we could have gotten in years. If you go online, you can get more information in a day than we could have gotten in a year. So, good. That's good. There's less angst among the parents, which leads to less angst among the kids. Unschooling is all about learning, and it's none about teaching. One kind of little tool or trick to, if what I said just now felt good, then no problem. If what I said just now seemed a little disturbing, what you might want to do is list 5 things that you learned after you were 12. that you didn't learn in any kind of school classroom way. You didn't pay anybody to teach you. You know, five real things that you learned after you were already nearly grown, teenager or older. And then think of three friends of yours, you might think of lots more, who are making a living doing something that they didn't learn in school. And if you just write those down, if you have any problem getting this, write down five things you learned and three people who are making a living, and I think that right there will shake loose some of your fears. Unschooling is about beginning with that, beginning at that point, and not doing the preparation for real life, but beginning right there and learning in real ways. Coming to understand and accepting that that's really a good way to learn, that it's good that your children just came across something accidentally and you didn't tell them. If they discover a cocoon and bring it in and end up with a moth in the drawer, you know, don't feel like you messed up by not explaining it to them in advance. It'll be way more memorable if they're surprised. So don't, you can't tell them everything in the whole wide world. I worry about these talks. I worry that I won't tell you everything in an hour. And it's like, yeah, if I could tell you everything I knew in an hour, why would they fly me over here to do it? So that's the good thing. It's like the tip of the iceberg. And then I always think, I won't say the one most important thing. That, oh, I should have said that thing. That's not the thing I said. But it's so different for every person because everyone here is picking it up in a different way because you're tying it to whatever's already in you, what you're ready to hear, what you didn't know. And so some of it will just go by, you know that, know that, know that. Ooh, I didn't know that. So I don't know what the one perfect thing is because there are too many of you and I don't know you. And something that I say that I think is just a dumb thing I shouldn't even mention might be the one important thing for somebody. And it's the same with your kids. So you don't know when you go to the county fair, you don't know which one of them is going to get most excited about the pie contest, and you didn't even mean to go in that building, you know, you meant to go to the baby chickens. So you don't worry. If your life seems random and your kids pick up random stuff, that's fantastic. That's great. I don't mind babies. If you just want to like stay in the back, that's fine with me. School says, and people say, and relatives say, school prepares you for the real world. To say that school prepares you for the real world pretty much declares right there that school isn't part of the real world. It says, here's us, and there's the real world. It's kind of like purgatory to get to heaven or something. So I kind of think my kids are in the real world, but then the next thought, however knee-jerk and unclean it is, well, that's not fair. They didn't suffer. You know, they don't get to go to the real world straightway. You have to prepare for the real world. And I understand that thinking, that it's not fair thinking, but I don't want to sacrifice my children's, too late now, because the youngest is 15, I'm safe, woo-hoo. But I would not have wanted to sacrifice my kids' learning just for the sake of someone else feeling like it was more fair. Because it probably wouldn't have been fair anyway. If Holly had been there, some other girl might not have been the cutest girl in her class. I don't know. Holly thinks she's that cute. She might hear this. Holly's really, really, really beautiful. And you know, Kirby might have been the class clown, and so the guy who's the class clown now would have been aced out. I don't know. You never know, because there's so many factors and all this interpersonal stuff, you cannot tell whether another path you might have taken would have been fantastic or disastrous. I have an ex-boyfriend that sometimes I think about, and then I think, oh, I could have gone this way, you know, the little fantasy that leads up to being happy and having, you know, superiorly intelligent children or whatever. And then the other more likely one that leads to, we were young, we would have had fights, we would have been divorced, and it would have been horrible. So it's the same with thinking about school, or should I homeschool this way or that way. Any scenario that you spin in your mind, you don't know for sure that you're imagining the way it would have been. Maybe school would have been horrible. And it was easy for me to believe that school could be horrible, even though it was great for me, because two of my friends killed themselves dead with guns, one at 14 and one at 15. And I liked them and I knew them, and we were in band together, and one of them had been kind of my little, you know, young life boyfriend. So if someone tells me, yes, but school can be terrible, it's like, I know, it was terrible for Charles and Alice, but it wasn't terrible for me. I haven't heard people say unschooling was terrible, terrible, and I don't think there have been any unschooling-related suicides at all, not even nearly. I mean, I don't think there are any kids saying, boy, I wish we were getting a curriculum because I can't stand this creative free stuff. I have a famous story, and famous in my head, probably some of you have heard it. That's what I mean by famous. It means I keep repeating it. Sorry. But it was a profound moment. It was in an online chat. Before we had web pages, there were only sort of grubby little message board. What did they call those? User groups. User groups where you sort of leave an email for everybody and you don't know who's reading it and very disorganized. But then there were chats. AOL came out, and for $3 an hour, people could go online and chat. And so, ooh, that reminds me. My pocket could start playing Gilligan's Island at any moment. Sorry. Okay. What was I talking about before phones? Oh, yeah. Pam Sarushian was in this chat with me. We're talking to other unschoolers. And they used to come every Tuesday afternoon, 1 to 3. This is burned in my memory. Tuesday, 1 to 3, I can't do anything, have this chat. And so somebody came in and said, how many hours does this take? And at the very same time, you know, typing at the same time in a chat room, one of us said all of it, you know, all of them, and the other one said none of them. And that's about how it goes. It's like, it takes no special hours, but it takes all of your hours. It takes living a different way. So it's like, yeah, your whole life, but there's not the time that you're unschooling and the time that you're not. It's not like, okay, good thing we're done with that. Okay, 2 days off. Because it just doesn't work that way. But you can try it if you want to. You could try just experimentally saying, we really need 3 months vacation from learning, so between now and November, let's just don't learn anything. And if you catch them learning something, make them stop. And by doing that, that will help your confidence too. Because if you can't stop it, then you don't have to worry about whether it's happening. So that was the famous profound story, the moment that one of us said all of it and the other one said none of it. So what do parents need to unschool? What do they need? If you want to be an unschooler, what do you need to go gather up? You need to be excitable and calm. You need to be very decisive and totally flexible. You need to be very confident and know what you want to do, and then you need to be so fluid that you're willing to accept any sort of other plan that comes along. And so far, everything. You need to be everything. You need to have the willingness to examine your own beliefs and prejudices, and that's a big one, and it doesn't sound like a big one, because you think it doesn't have anything to do with your kids, that you could just leave them alone. But it's almost impossible to leave someone alone if they're doing something that strikes you as wrong or dangerous. Because even if you don't say something, you're going to act like that. You're going to, like, tighten up and bristle and grunt and roll your eyes and, you know, generally act like a 14-year-old schoolgirl. And so if you find yourself doing that, something's in you. If you find yourself irritated with what your kids are doing and the choices that they're making, think about why. And a lot of times it's because the parent is having the feeling, that's not fair. I had to suffer. How come they're not suffering? And you're laughing, but I bet you've had that feeling. You know? It's like, how come my kid has $15 and I used to have 35 cents? And, you know, and it's equivalent in whatever other area of life. You need to have time to do it. It's really hard with two full-time jobs. It's not impossible. But two full-time jobs, 9 to 5 with a lot of commute, it's very difficult. But what people forget when they say, well, I can't unschool at all anymore because I have to get a job. So go, why can't you get a babysitter? And they go, because my kid's 12. And they say, I don't really mean a babysitter, I mean a place for the kid to be. Well, but she doesn't want to teach him. Well, I don't mean somebody to teach him, I mean someplace for him to hang out. Or somebody to hang out with him. And another good little, are there any people here who are really new? Could you raise your hand if you just like are not yet in unschooling, you're just thinking about it or you never much heard of it? Okay, good. Thank you. I feel better because I didn't want to say things that everybody knew. Okay, here's a good trick if you're not sure. Figure out how many hours your kids are in school in your district, and then figure out how many hours there are in a week, total hours in a week. And then it won't seem like such a big deal anymore because there are a lot of hours in the week. And even if your kid sleeps all day, all the time that you're at work, your kid's asleep. That's a lot of sleep, and then you have a lot of time to be with your kid. Because it's not like learning has to happen Monday through Friday, 8 to 3. Adults have that vision in their mind sometimes because of many, 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 many years of conditioning of which are the times that you should just get to run around and play or have to do chores and which are the times that you have to be learning. And have to be learning is so funny. Because I also think back to school and I can remember the times that we learned something. like something exciting happened that day. I knew I was there, and then something new happened that I had never known in my life that was exciting, that was cool, and I, you know, worth going home and telling mom about. Millions of mothers every day say, "What did you learn today?" And millions of kids say nothing. And they're telling the truth. So you need patience. Part of it, patience with yourself to get it. Don't say, "Well, I'm gonna try this for a week, and if it doesn't work, that's it. If it doesn't, it won't come in a week." That's like a little kid saying, "Am I tall yet? Am I tall yet? Am I tall?" And Holly has this story. She remembers when she got tall because you see over the kitchen counter. And at some point, you will see over the kitchen counter of unschooling. But you can't rush it. It just happens one day that it's like, "Oh, I used to be so afraid of this, and now I can see the whole thing. I didn't know it was up there, and now I do." You need to have compassion, again, for yourself and for your kids. You know, don't rush things. Don't get mad at yourself just because you blew up and said, "I guess you'll never learn math. I guess I'll have to run your checkbook my whole life." And people do. People get like that. But, you know, just don't beat yourself up. Just go, "Oh, there." Put that on the checklist of things to try not to do again. Or not to do with the second and third kid. You know, you got to do it with the first kid, poor guys. I was a firstborn, so I know. And if you meet Kirby, he's not my best sample. He's the trial model. It helps to have joy, to just be able to be happy, to be hopeful, to see the good things in anything. In, "Oh man, you know, bird pooped on my windshield, but my windshield's not cracked." You know, look for a good thing. Every time you have a bad thought, think of a good thought, because you can spiral down into being so depressed and your kids won't want to hang around with you. Or you can keep yourself buoyed up so that you're fun and that you're having fun and they're having fun. So somehow try to maintain that joy. Figure out how to generate or induce some. Curiosity is great. And not just the sort of passive curiosity where you're curious about what your kids want to know and you help them find the answers, but that you want to know too. If what you're thinking of that you want to look up isn't something your kids would be interested in, well, forget your kids. You know, do it for your own sake. Don't try to turn everything into unschooling, and it's tempting at first when you're new to it, to make every second count, to make every activity, every question that you answer, every conversation you have, something that you could write up and send to a homeschooling magazine. And there will probably be some. There will be some that are totally worth writing down, at least for your own self, at least for a diary or to send to your parents or something. And some that, after a while, months will go by when I don't think anything was special enough to write down because it's so common for us. It's no longer special for us. And that's a kind of a comfortable place to be. And gradually people get there. So sorry. This is important too, and they talk about this in medical communities about needing to want to get well. You need to want to make it work. You need to not just kind of casually think, "Okay, I'm going to try this because it'll save me that $600 that the curriculum would have cost." It needs to be for more reason than that. It needs to be because you've seen it, you've seen that spark in someone else's family and you want to try to get it. Because you need to desire it enough that it affects the way you make your choices. That seems simple, but it's not easy. And the idea that something is simple but not easy carries through a lot of unschooling. It's like when I explain it, everybody goes, "Well, that just sounds obvious." Okay, do it. It's not as easy to do it because of the conditioning and because of the fears. Some people don't really want to get it. They want to say they tried it. They're going down a checklist. It's kind of like being on unemployment. "Yeah, I applied for a job. Yeah, I applied for two jobs. Give me my check." And so they're going to try this curriculum, and they know it's not going to work, and it doesn't. They're going to try this other curriculum, but it's not going to work because it's stupid, and then it doesn't work. Okay, I'm going to try unschooling. If that doesn't work, we're sending him to school. And they're just not really into it. They're just trying it. So if you have all that, then all you need is money. People say, "Well, it doesn't cost anything to unschool," but the danger with that is that people then won't want to spend anything. But you should spend at least what you would if they were in the public schools. If your kid's going to a public school, even though the school's free, you still have to buy clothes and school supplies and probably pay lab fees and gym fees and sports fees. And sometimes there are field trips and that costs money. So I don't mean count it up by the penny and, you know, keep a ledger and stop spending when you get to that point either. I just mean don't think it's not going to cost you anything. But it shouldn't cost you as much as the most expensive private school in town either. But some people try to go absolutely cheap where they don't spend a single penny. And that's just not going to work. And you can also justify some of your expenses because of homeschooling. I got a microscope that I might not have bought if the kids were in school. Because people will say, they'll get to use a microscope at school. Some kids do and some kids don't. And sometimes you're in chemistry for a whole year or biology for a whole year and you get to use the microscope about twice for about a minute. So if you have your own, every time you come up on a lovely dead bug or good scab or something, there it is. And you can, so that's a justifiable thing. You know, those kinds of expenses might be. And memberships to aquariums and museums and zoos, those are great. Because then you don't have to feel like you have to see the whole thing. And sometimes the most expensive thing of going to the zoo is lunch. So if you can just go for a couple of hours and then go home and eat, and go back in a week and see something else. You can also just pick and choose from feeding times and shady days, and overcast days are good for the zoo because the animals come out. It's not so bad for you. So it can change the way you make your decisions if you've put enough money in that you don't have to feel like, oh, it's going to cost me another $15 to get in there or whatever. It's relaxing, and it's an investment in your children. Time, I already mentioned time, but ditto on time about the time that they would have spent in school. And people go, well, she wants me to spend like 5 hours a day with her. And I'm like, okay, spend 5 hours a day with her. But I thought that unschooling was like they'll just do stuff on their own. Eventually they will. But not when they're five, not when they're eight maybe. Depends on the kid. But parents shouldn't try to get out of doing any work either. It shouldn't be something that doesn't cost you a penny and doesn't take you any time at all. That's called neglect. So how much time to spend it's totally going to depend on the situation. But anybody who's trying to get by with less time than the kid is in school, or not even spending as much time with the kid as they would have spent with them if they were driving him back and forth, that's tacky. I don't have to make him breakfast because he doesn't have to go to school. Yeah, but he's still hungry. I mean, he might want to eat in a leisurely fashion with your mom, you know, sitting there with his mom. Consider it. And so it's possible to be very lavishly generous with your child, with time and attention. And I think it's great when people can do that, when a parent is calm, not all hyper like I am, but really calm, and can really listen to the kids' dreams and what they thought last night and what they thought when they woke up. I do it sometimes, and when I do, I notice, which means it's not very common with me. You know, it's not as, it's one of those things that I go, wow, I was really, really still and quiet and patient with Holly for 20 minutes. Because she wakes up later than I do. By the time she gets up, I've already been running all around, been to the store, da-da-da-da, zip-zip-zip. And she wants to just very quietly tell me what happened before she went to bed and what she thought. So that kind of patience is a huge gift that you can give a child, because I bet you have seen or maybe been in a family where the kids are woken up, it's late, hurry, 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 hurry. Oh, where are your pants? Oh, they're in the dryer. Hurry, hurry, hurry. And it's like that when they wake up, it's like that when they get picked up from school, it's like that when they have to go to bed, and there's no slowing down and just being. And the last thing on my list of things that parents need to unschool is a house kids can live in. And that's another, yeah, well, we knew that, kids live there. No, I mean a house that the kids can feel like they can do things in. Not that they're visitors, and not that they're servants, but a place where they feel like they live. And school is never that place. Kids are just moved from room to room. They're told to put the stuff back on the shelf just a certain way. They're told that, you know, if they break it, they're in trouble, da-da-da, don't waste the paper. And there's a lot of pressure on kids at school to not make a mess. And if a house is that way too, although I understand there are some OCD people who really have to have their house just so, and it can't be helped, but at least you can maybe recognize that that's your compulsion and not your child's compulsion, and not that... 19th century tradition seemed to be that families would be thrilled if they had a bunch of sons because then they could have farm labor. You know, don't do that at your house. Don't say, oh good, I have five girls. I never have to wash dishes again. It's the same kind of, you know, growing your own servants mentality that a lot of people will support. You probably still have older aunts and uncles who expect you to do that, who expect you to make your kids do all your work and all your errands and all your babysitting. But think about each one. Each time there's a case that you're going to try to make somebody do something or bribe or persuade someone to do something for you, think about the relationship between you and that person. I have a next door neighbor, he's 85 maybe, grew up in southern New Mexico and was forced to cut firewood. That was his job. He was an only child, and he cut firewood, and he cut firewood, and he cut firewood till he thought there would be no end of the world. And now he will not put a fire in his fireplace. He just told himself that when he moved away from his parents' house, he would never cut wood again. And he has a nice fireplace, and I feel bad. So we got a wood-fired hot tub, and I brought him over and said, Harry, come look what we got. It's the coolest toy. It's got a submerged stove in there, and it's just so neat. We can burn pallet wood. We can burn junk wood. And Harry said, you're cutting wood for fun. So he's 85, and he hasn't gotten over it yet. But as far as making your house a good unschooling house, Pam Sarushian came up with a good term for it until she looked. She said it's like a nest. Make a nest. If the environment in your house is a good learning environment and a peaceful environment and a safe environment and a happy learning environment, then you've just created a place where unschooling can work really, really well, where the child wants to be there. I felt really good. Good in the sort of Snoopy happy dance kind of way sometimes when my kids wanted to come home, especially now that they can all drive and we have enough cars that pretty much on a good day, if none of the cars are in the shop, all the kids could be gone different places in different cars. But more often than not, they're all three gone somewhere in the same car. I like that. But I really like that sometimes they'll come back, like in a while. They go out to dinner with friends, and given all those friends' houses and all the places in town that they could hang out, they come to our house to hang out. And I don't do the superior dance to them. But then when other parents are saying, well, you know, kids only come home when you make them come home, or, well, you have to have a curfew or they'll never come home, then I know that's not true. And that's kind of sweet. It's very comforting to me to know that they feel safe coming there. That costs us a little bit of money, too, because before Kirby could drive, he had gamer friends who were older. Some of them had cars, you know, and they could get places. But the gaming shop would close at a certain time, or sometimes it was magic night, and they couldn't play the other games they wanted to play because all the tables were full. And we have one big room and a couple of big tables up there. So what Keith and I did was we would buy a lot of what we refer to at the home as freezer food, you know, microwave pizzas and sandwiches and whatever you can stick in the microwave for a minute and a half. And we got that because the high school boys will eat it, because we couldn't afford to make them real food. And then sometimes they didn't show up till midnight. You know, they're there playing games till 4 in the morning. So if we always had juice and, you know, some sodas and some water and some snacks, so we bought snacky food to lure other kids over to our house, because then we knew where the kids were. We could have said, don't eat our food, go home and eat your own food. That would not have been as good for us. So it cost us a little bit of money to keep them all hydrated and snacked up so they could last. And they get along better, too. Kids are more likely to fight if they're hungry. And it was way cheaper than trying to give them enough money to go to McDonald's at 3 in the morning or something, and probably better food, too, sad to say. So sometimes we just make quesadillas or something that's cheap and plentiful and has protein and keeps teenage boys afloat. So that was part of our nest, I guess. And in that nest, in that environment, you need input and stimuli, toys, puzzles. And I don't mean just flat jigsaw puzzles, but things that you put together and take apart. Construction sets, magnets, you know, things that people can sit and doodle with, because they'll learn things physically from the way the things work, and it's also a good way for them to just sit and be calm and talk. You can talk really well and have some great conversations while you're both doing a puzzle or while you're all playing with some construction blocks, Lego or something. It's nice to have music and art. Not just art supplies, stuff that they can mess with, but, you know, real art, nice painting stuff. Even just open web pages of things that you think might be nice for them to see. And the nest isn't just at our house, and kind of that along the lines of that open classroom model. The theory of open classroom is you should take them out to every farm and factory and stuff and let them see it, but that's not really practical with schools and school buses and liability and permission slips and money. But with homeschooling, you can do it. You can just go somewhere. If you happen to be passing by somewhere, if you have a friend who works somewhere, that you can go see them at work, and the kids, just even if they don't get to get in and see everything, at least they can just see the place. the outsider, you know, what you can see just by going there. That's great for your kids. They know more what adults do. They know what's out in the world. They know what all those buildings are that usually just pass by and see buildings. And expanding your learning environment, your nest, out from the house is another thing that sometimes people don't think they have to do. It's a big trap to only do what you think you have to do. And when people ask me those questions, I get a little defensive because I think they don't really want to do it. When they go, well, do I have to do that? Like, you don't have to do anything. Put your kids in school next. That's how patient I am when it seems like people are trying to get me to tell them that they hardly have to do anything. No, if we only do what we have to do, we're not going to be doing a very good job. And do what you can do. Do as much as you can of what your kids would like to do. So I want to talk about blocks, because I talked about puzzles. There are pattern blocks, and I usually play them flat. I put them down. There's like really nice stained wood. There's six-sided and a bunch of little triangles and stuff that people have called attribute blocks. And we have two sets. They're really comforting, and they're pretty, and I always make flat designs. But a lot of kids, littler kids especially, will come up and make sculptures. They'll pile them and stack them up, and I didn't think of that because that's not what it showed on the picture. You know, that's how you're supposed to. So it's really cool that they'll do what they're not supposed to. But there's a kind of learning that's like that called the very methodical learning. So if you want to think of blocks as in cinder block wall, you know, just start like a brick wall. Start in a corner, make a really strong corner, and put one and one, you know, make your row, make it all flat. I'm not disparaging that when it needs to be done. My husband did some block work in our backyard, and his dad, who's very stingy with compliments, bragged it all up the other day, and I forgot to tell him. I came here and didn't say, your dad said this behind your back. But he said, this Keith did this? This is really good. It's like a professional. So I need to tell Keith that. He won't believe me. No, he will. Serialist learning. There's a guy in England who writes about learning. His last name's Atherton. I'm not thinking of his first name right now. Anybody know? Might be on here. But just, he gathers up everybody's theories and puts it in little these small, little, very understandable pages. And one thing he's talking about is serialist learning, people who learn things in sequence from the bottom up. So I can't show you the picture because I have no technology here, but just think of the way school is supposed to be. There's kindergarten math, kindergarten reading, kindergarten history, kindergarten science. First grade math, first grade reading, and their idea is to build this very solid wall, flat on both sides, builds up, builds up, builds up. Anything that's not in the plan, anything that's not in that blueprint, you don't need. And if you complete the blueprint, you're guaranteed to have a wall that will get you through life, prepare you for the real world. And that's serialist learning. Some people are just that way. Some people on their own, even, if they want to learn something, they really want to start at the beginning and practice and practice and then move to step two. So it is a natural thing. The kind of learning that works better for unschooling, this researcher, James Atherton, this is not his theory. He's just explaining someone else's theory. He said this is called holistic learning. Then holists fill in the gaps. They sort of do hit and miss stuff, gather whatever they naturally came across, and then they connect the gaps. I think that's a lot easier. But I'm not a professional house painter. I know professional house painters kind of like to start in one corner and do a whole wall methodically because they're trying to save paint or something. There are factors because the paint costs money and they're getting paid by the hour. But what if paint didn't cost money and you weren't getting paid by the hour? It seems a little like it'd be fun and eventually you'd get the wall painted if you just kind of painted wherever you felt like and then came back and painted together. And I know it wouldn't all be the same shade if you were trying to do a professional job. But with learning, it can work like that. If you just, for some reason, get all interested in Russia, and you just find everything you can about Russia and the Soviet Union and the Vikings and Constantinople, and you know, just anything that vaguely connects to it, you gather that up and you play with it, you watch movies, you bring books home, and then you just never really look at that again. Still, it's in there. It's one of your bricks to fasten other things to. And another thing about this kind of learning, the holistic model, the picture that he has on his website is blocks numbered randomly and not all flat, some bigger, some smaller, some out. If you think of it as the solid serialist wall that school tries to build, there's no dimension to it but just the height and the width and the not very thick, because you don't have to, because you only have 180 days a year. sessions last 50, 55 minutes. It's like it's got to be in parts that fit that schedule. But you're not limited to that at all when you're unschooling. You might learn a whole lot in 30 seconds by some sort of accidental thing. Like on my birthday, we're having a birthday party, and I noticed that people were running around kind of whispering and making faces like, come here, come here, come here, don't, shh, come here. And Keith came and said, do you know where the flat nozzle is for the shop vac? And I said, no. He said, that's okay. And and so I asked another friend of ours who was there, do they need me to go help them? He said, no. And I said, do you think they could make out of foil? Do you think they could make a foil? He said, it would collapse. And I said, they're fine. They did it. So it was neat. It was kind of nice because I knew they were protecting me from something, but I didn't care because we were playing a game and there were a lot of people and we were having fun. And so 10 after 12, the last people had gone home, and Holly said, so Mom, I didn't really understand about Marty breaking that window. And I said, what window? And so I was picturing maybe one of the, we have an old closed-in porch, kind of like a glass room, and I thought maybe one of those windows, that'd be a drag. But it was the back window of Keith's 64 Dodge pickup, which he shot with a BB gun because he was trying to shoot a balloon. But then they ran out of balloons. Somebody brought to my party helium balloons, and with the helium balloons, we were breathing the helium and singing the Four Seasons and stuff because we were playing... we were playing Encore, so it was a singing game. And so if you were going to do something, you know, you might need it for Four Seasons or Michael Jackson, right? And so but some of the balloons did get tied off and they took them outside. And then we had a pinata. My poor friend, she never had little boys until just lately. She was living in England, and so she came and she decided to buy me a pinata. She's been out of the loop having no boys and being in England. So she brought me this big pinata, almost as tall as, you know, like, as tall as a five-year-old kid, full of candy, you know, you can feel it's full. And, you know, my 54th birthday, I finally get a piñata. But she said, it's a Mexican wrestler. Most of the people at my party were friends of Kirby's and Marty's. They all watched Power Rangers, and they said, this is the Red Ranger. We're going to kill the Red Ranger. And then they got over it, and they killed it. But it was cute at the party, too, because, you know, the tradition with piñatas is youngest up, right? So the youngest kid there was 5, and then there was an 8-year-old, and there was a 13, 15, 18, 19, 19, 20. So a whole bunch of people, but they all knew. They all knew who was next. That was fun. Before the piñata, it was the window. Ah, yes. Marty learned a lot about that. So after they finished the balloons, he was going to see if it could dent. He couldn't shoot an aluminum can, so he was going to see if it would dent steel. Only he missed the tailgate and hit the window. And if Holly hadn't mentioned that window, I would have found out anyway because they left all the pictures on the digital camera, and I was going to download them the next day anyway. And one of the pictures is a movie. You know, they'll take those little few second movies. He took a movie of the safety glass breaking. So I'm kind of glad Holly had given me the clue and I didn't find that movie because it would have been like 6 in the morning. I wouldn't have wanted to wake him up and talk to him about it. And Marty himself paid for the replacement of that window. So sometimes when you don't, you want just want to see if a BB dents steel, you get a whole new different kind of lesson. It won't dent steel. With the holistic learning, where you never know what you're going to break or find or have given to you in the guise of a Mexican wrestler, the blocks that you're filling in involve history, the past, the future, the imagined, the possible, the failed attempt. I mean, it's just way richer than school. School doesn't tend to say, okay, remember this forever, the way we messed this up. The teachers go, just don't tell your parents. You know, it's not like a glory thing when something is all screwed up. It's like, oh, that went wrong. That's bad. That doesn't count. But I know I had a little printer machine. They're out of style now because there's so many color printers in the world, but it was a screen printer from Japan, and it worked with bulbs. Didn't even use electricity, and you burn the master, and then you put ink in there, and you can make all the copies you want on plastic or cloth or toilet paper. It's great. You could print on anything. but the company's going out of business because it's not so popular. But anyway, I had one, and several of my friends had them, and when I would be around someone who was thinking of buying one or using one for the first time, I would say, okay, don't do this, and if you put this in backwards, this happens, and if you do this, this happens, because I had screwed up. It was a list of the things I had done wrong. And so that was really valuable because none of my friends had to make those same mistakes. And I know parents hope to do that with their kids, to tell them everything that could go wrong. And Marty will. I know Marty's going to tell his kids, don't shoot a BB gun at a pickup. I know it. But I didn't tell my kid. So I tell them the things that I messed up or that I got hurt with or that I got in trouble for. Because you can't tell people everything because I keep trying. How much time do I have? Speaking of that, I turned off my phone, and now I don't know what time it is. Okay, thanks. When people are doing the serial learning, they don't want to talk about what might have been, what didn't happen. There's a map. Marty likes maps, and there's a map for sale at the museum in Albuquerque. It's a map done by surveyors of where the railroad isn't. It was their first plan for the railroad. And so it's a really cool map, but it's not a right map because it doesn't show the railroad where it is. I thought that was really interesting. But for school, they would never put that in a school book. You know, and Marty ended up not buying it either because he only had so much map money to spend that day. But that's interesting to figure out why they decided to put it somewhere else if for people who are interested in that sort of thing. But serialists, another huge problem with serialists is they're building toward one particular block. By the time you get to high school, they might already have pegged you as a science person, and they're going to try to make sure you get chemistry and physics before you leave high school. Or they might think you're going to do literature, and so they want to make sure you get a poetry class and Shakespeare before you get to college, or whatever it is. And a lot of times people will, I don't want to say a lot of times. Occasionally, a family will have some goal, like my kid's going to be an Olympic figure skater. And they work toward that. They make their choices based on does this or does this not get us quickly closer to Olympic figure skating medal, gold medal, not silver. And the problem is their odds of success are very small and beyond their control. And their odds of failure are very, very, very high. And so if you do the scattery thing and you go, wow, my kid is interested in 15 different things. We have no idea which one is going to jump out and offer him a job. If you're really well-rounded and you can do lots of different things, you're probably more likely to be invited into a randomly wonderful situation you never could have foreseen than if you're focused on being a figure skater and have to totally overlook some other kind of situation or opportunity. So the scattery learning can be seen as disorganization and laziness, but I don't see it that way. I know some people just dismiss it. And they say, no, you're just too lazy to actually get a schedule and teach your kids like if he was in school. If I wanted my kids to be taught as if they were in school, there's a school walking distance from my house. That's how schools work. They're right there. If you're not walking distance, they will send a bus for you. Gladly. So it's not that I'm not keeping my kids home because I can do it better. I'm keeping my kids home because I don't want it done. And that's not even a fair way to say it because I always asked them. I used to ask them every year, do you want to go to school this year? You want to try school? And it was an honest question. It wasn't a trick question. And if they had said yes, I would have let them go. And when Holly wanted to go, it was eighth grade. We used to go park by the school in the afternoon sometimes. She would say, let's go look at school kids. And what she meant was, let's go park where they will pass by and we'll watch them. Sometimes it was before school. We'd watch them get on buses or we'd watch them get off buses. And she would just sit there like an anthropologist would, you know, and observing them in their natural habitat. And sometimes we would park after school, and if you go after school, you can park where the parents haven't come, and so we get a front row view, and they'd open the doors, and the kids would come out, and she was really fascinated by who would walk up to other kids and talk, and who would just walk off alone, and how they wore their backpacks, and what they were wearing, and how quickly some of them turned their phones on and called somebody, and how quickly some of them, you know, stalled, didn't want to go home right away. Some wanted to go home right away. And that's the school she would have gone to, and some friends of hers were there, and they would wave at her, kind of like, why are you here? And I think we probably went there 8 or 9 times after school, and several trips in the morning, or we would go, and when kids were on a field trip, somewhere where we were, we would kind of hang around them and listen to what they were doing. So she could hear how the teachers treated them. So she did school like that. She went to school in England 2 days in uniform and everything with a friend of hers. And that was, but that's, it's not the same when you're a visitor, because everybody's, oh, ooh, you're American, tell us this, tell us that. Do you really have a coin called a quarter? So, you know, I mean, that was, it was easy, but it was too easy, it was too fun, because she was the center of attention, so it wasn't realistic at all. I want to talk more about that Sunday morning. Sunday morning, first I'm speaking about, I never put this mic on. Sunday morning, first I'm speaking about connections, and then after that, a parenting talk. Here's another little mantra you can have if you're worried about unschooling. Take the kid home, don't take the school home. And then some people who are new to it go, well, I disagree with that, or I don't think that can work. And I just have come to be more confident in it, and now I think you don't have to do things my way, but the fact that my way works means you don't have to do it that same old way either. Because people, it's easy to say, well, we have to, we don't have any choice. This is how it is, this is what we have to do. But I don't think it's so. The way learning works with you, if you think about that, the way you're learning about unschooling, if you're new to it, the way you did learn about it, or the way you learn about a new car you get or a new computer, that's the way kids learn about everything, only pretty much faster and happier. And it's easy for a parent to say, this thing that they're learning about isn't important. I want them to learn about something I think is important. My granny in Texas was born in 1902 or so. She expressed to me the fact that she was worried that I would not know how to milk a cow. I've never had a cow. I never lived in a place that was big enough to have a cow, really. Had a horse one time. Didn't milk it. That was good. And she wanted me to know how to use a fountain pen. So I got a fountain pen and learned how to use it. And then she felt better. But, you know, it's not practical. I did learn calligraphy so I can use a dip pen. I made a pen one time out of a goose quill. Now my granny, you know, that's too much. I didn't have to do that. I did too much. I should have just quit at what she wanted me to do and not done extra. But it's unpredictable and it's individual. I don't know what you want to learn. Maybe there's some people here who are really worried because I know one family's dog had to go to the vet this morning. Maybe they're here and they're thinking about their dog. Or maybe you're just thinking, this is crazy. I'm wasting my time in here because I'm going to go buy that really pretty curriculum in that box I saw in the other room. So I don't know what people are thinking. All I can do is tell you stories. And some people look very attentive and some people don't. And that's fine because I know how to look attentive when I'm not. And sometimes I draw. Sometimes I draw a lot while I'm listening, and it's not because I'm not listening, it's because it keeps me from getting up and walking around because I have that nervous energy. So, but still, you know, there's not going to be a test, and if you want a certificate of completion, those certificates of empowerment are around there. You can take that home so you can prove you came, and then if your mom says, what'd you learn, you can go, this. My mom, when she was little, was involved in picking cotton in Texas. They didn't own cotton. They would go pick other people's cotton. And they would live in one crummy two-room wood cabin after another and during the Depression and all that stuff. But when she was a little kid, her grandmother, her mom, my granny, had taught her the days of the week by singing it to Yankee Doodle. And if you sing the whole song, you get a whole month. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, like that. So if you have kids now, they will consider that not to be the tune to Yankee Doodle, but the tune to Barney. It still works. But my mom didn't teach me that, and I remember being in second grade and painstakingly trying to figure out how I'm going to remember that Thursday comes after Wednesday. I couldn't get it. It was just like noise. I'm reciting noise. And I was older. I was a teenager when she told me this story. And it's like, why didn't you tell me that when I was little and I was really struggling to learn that? And the reason she didn't is because her mom taught it to her at home. She went to school, was playing on the playground at recess and singing this song. And the teacher got excited about it. And when they got back in the room, said, Mary Lou, sing that song about the days of the week that you were singing. And she didn't want to. And she was really embarrassed. And she made her come up and stand in front of them and sing that. And it just shut it down in her head. So after that, she didn't like that song. And when I was little, she didn't. I don't know if she still had it blocked out or was just afraid that if she taught it to me, I would be forced to sing in front of the whole school. And so she didn't. And that's one of the examples that I was thinking when I said, you need to examine your own fears and prejudices. Don't deprive your kids of something just because you have a wound about it. Try to get over your wound. That makes you a better parent anyway. Makes you a better person anyway. If there's something that you know kind of traumatized you, either talk to friends about it or read self-help books or go to a counselor or something. I mean, seriously, if it's serious enough that you're not going to treat your kids the way you would like to treat them, might be worth looking at. House cleaning time for the school closet, since you're thinking about it anyway. There's a kind of a hard topic with unschooling that doesn't come up very often because people argue with me about it. They get angry and they don't understand it. But somebody sent me, Pam Sirishian, sent me back an email that I had written a long time ago where I had said I didn't use schoolish terminology with Kirby. I consciously didn't ever use those school terms to him, math, history, science, English, you know, literature, because I just wanted him to like things regardless of what they would be categorized in school, or to reject things because he didn't like it, not because it was history or was science. Because there will be somebody, usually littler kids, who'll say, I hate history. But they don't know what they're talking about. I mean, they hate that class in school, or they hate, again, hearing about Columbus. But that doesn't mean they don't like Egypt, or they don't like, you know, East Coast Indians and their bark houses. You know, so there's something that they'll be thrilled to know, but once they find out it's history, they go, oh, I hate history. And so that wound goes deep with people, and sometimes with the parents. Sometimes the parents hate history, or don't understand math, or don't like science, without even really looking. They're still just parroting like a little third, fourth grader. They're just saying, I hate that. I hate that because I hated that teacher, without looking at what it is. And science is a huge, huge field, what they call science in schools. From stars to microscopic bugs, you know what, snails, monkeys in the jungle, that's all science? That doesn't make sense. So if someone's not at all interested in geology, that doesn't mean they might not be interested in snowflakes, and they shouldn't be considered the same thing. So I didn't use those terms. And so someone asked me in a discussion, and I said, terms before examples are confusing static. Terms after examples are just more vocabulary, like clock or dog. You wouldn't try to explain to a little baby what a clock is if you've never seen one. But when they point at it and go, ah, dat, you say clock. And so you might wait till they point at something like astronomy and then not go, oh, I'm so glad you asked. This is science. This is science as sure as a snail is science. That doesn't even make sense to them. So you just confuse them. And it's the same with math at our house. Once they started figuring out the patterns, then we would tell them what it was. If they said, oh, hey, look, these numbers go up in this pattern, we go, yeah, that's multiplication. There are patterns. There are patterns in a lot of the numbers. And someone told me, though, in writing, and here it is, they should integrate those terms into their lives. It's like, what, I'm supposed to do their integration for them? Let them figure it out. You know, you can't do that. You can't go to someone and say, you need to know this, and you need to apply it in the following 10 ways, although I'm kind of doing that with you now. But don't do what I do. But, you know, you don't know what your kids need to know. And so you just kind of have to go with that flexible flow. I didn't live in California, and people in Sacramento don't have a beach either, but, you know, we didn't have surfing in New Mexico, but we used to ride the school bus standing up without holding on because it was cool. And so that whole idea about just shifting your weight, that's kind of what you have to do as a parent too. It's like, okay, I thought we were going to talk about math for 2 hours, but now he's off on something else. So even if you think, somebody asks you a cool question, you think they want the long explanation, it's like, mommy, where did I come from? You know, okay. And after the mom tells a whole bunch of stuff, she goes, okay, because Timmy says he came from Chicago, right? So sometimes they just want the really, really short answer. And it might be disappointing if they finally asked about the thing you know most about and care most about in the whole wide world, and they just want to know, you know. They don't want to know all about race cars in the whole history of Earth. They just wanted to know what state Indianapolis was in. Alliteration. I like alliteration. I think it's cool, and I've read a fair amount of Viking and Saxon poetry, not in Old English, but, you know, translations, but they keep the names. And sometimes parents love to give the kids vocabulary, but this is a good example. There's no sense ever telling a kid about alliteration until they come and tell you, isn't it interesting that Peter Parker and Clark Kent and those names always start with the same letter? And then you can say, oh, yeah, there's a name for that. They may or may not want to know. But they'll figure it out, because Lois Lane and Clark Kent match. And if they figure out something like that, don't go, yeah, I know. You know, that, because that's kind of off-putting. They'll say, everybody knows that. You're not the first to figure out that. Say, oh, that's cool, isn't it? Let's think of some more. Think of some more. Talk about it some more. Lex Luthor or whoever you can come up with. The guy on Unbreakable, he had a name like that too. Remember that Bruce Willis movie? Anybody remember his name? But that was another clue because he had one of those alliterative names. And then after you mess with it for a little bit, then maybe you can say, you know, that's called alliteration. Or about rhyme. Little kids discover rhyme for the first time. You know, three-year-olds or start talking, they mess with words, they get all excited. Don't go, everybody knows that. Go, that's so neat. And help them explore the way they want to explore it. Just like if they see a bug and they want to get down and touch it, you're probably going to let them do it. You're probably not going to go, everybody's seen that bug. You're just new to the world. Hello. Because it is exciting for them. I will quit after this, I think, because there's no quitting place. If I don't just go by the clock, I'd still be here. And so I can do that Sunday. I can just go, okay, switch out, wait a few minutes and start again. Sometimes adults will say to other adults, be serious, act your age, stop messing around. This isn't a joke. This is the real world. And they're just kind of casual put downs. They don't even think about what they're doing to you or what they're saying to you. It's just like conform. Stop being interesting. Stop being loud. Stop being obvious. Just be invisible so the rest of us can be invisible. But that doesn't work with unschooling. I think you should take it lightly, and I think you should act your kid's age sometimes. Because they need someone who can be enthusiastic about what they're excited about. And not to be jaded and old and cynical and negative. They need some joy. They need you to share their joy. So if you play with them, we've said at our house sometimes, it's not playing unless everybody's playing. It's not fair to be mean to somebody and then say you're playing. But if everybody is playing, then it's playing. If you play with words and you play with ideas and you play with sounds and you play with colors and you play with food, music, play in the rain. If your kid wants to go jump in a puddle, you could recite everything your grandparents ever said to you about not getting wet, don't mess up your shoes, and na-na-na-na. Or you could just put some shoes on them that you don't mind getting messed up and maybe go out with them into the puddle or at least let them go. Give them an umbrella, give them a bucket, let them go. And playing in the dark is fun with light sticks or flashlights or real fire. You know, put some birthday candles outside and let them light them or something because the dark is fun. And you should be, when you're being compassionate with yourself, you should be willing to laugh at yourself. If you do something that's silly or wrong or knee-jerk, just, you know, admit to your kids, like, I don't even know why I said that. I guess I'm tired and need some food. Because we'll do that to our kids. Do you need a nap? Are you hungry? And like, all insulting, like it's their fault they're tired or hungry. How could you do that to me? But I think we should do that to ourselves, too. It's like, okay, I'm getting really cranky. When's the last time I ate? Maybe I need a drink of water. You know, do that to yourself the same way you do it to a kid. Because you might need to go pee. And adults are really likely to ignore that. It's like, later, later, later. First I have to make you unhappy. Then I'll take care of my own needs. So please take these things out. And just as you make decisions and choices about your kids, try to make the nicer one. Give yourself two choices. Think of two things you might do. Because if you don't think of two things, you didn't make a choice. If you do the first thing that comes to mind, that's not mindful, that's not thoughtful, that's not thinking, and that's not a choice. So stop long enough to just think, I could do this thing or this other thing, and do the one that gets you closer to your goal. And with that, I am finished, except to say, if you didn't get certificate of empowerment. Are there any more? I think there's one on the floor back there. Is there still a pile in that back row? There's some here. Please get one. And if you want to see Kirby, the best way to see Kirby, if you want to see him today, is to go over to room 303 where we're going to sing. He's also on a panel Sunday afternoon at 3? The adult unschoolers, grown unschoolers panel. Do we have time? I have to be at 3:03 with my music out by 4. Okay, well, I'm legally obligated to stay 10 more minutes, ask questions. Room 303, I think. There's a singing workshop right after this. If you want to go right now, he's over in the teen room 121. And then he's speaking on a panel Sunday afternoon, the Grown Unschoolers panel. Anybody have a question then? It's a question about math. I need to speak to, I have to say it to this contractual obligation. I have to repeat the question, so don't make it so long I can't repeat it.
My question is, how do you handle math
at
higher level?
What do you do with higher math? It partly depends on the kid. There are a lot of things that they can discover on their own. I know Kirby and Marty figured out when they were still in the 10, 12 range. Their allowance rate was different, and their allowance rate was 75 cents times their age per week. We couldn't afford a dollar when we first started doing it, so it stayed at 75 cents. So they knew how much they made individually and together, and they wanted to buy a video game, a GameCube or something, and they figured out how much it would cost if they went together and what percentage each of them would own. Or should they just wait until Marty had saved as much, you know, half, and then Kirby put in half. And I didn't help them, and I didn't stop them. I just listened to it all, and that's a big-time algebra to have figured out the three different ways to do it. Do they just let Kirby pay most, or do they wait? Or I forgot what their other... They had several plans, and they ended up doing that. Now Kirby's moving out. Kirby's moving away on Wednesday to Texas. And we went through the ordeal of which games stay here and which systems go and which systems stay. And which DVDs are really yours. And luckily he has an iPod, so I get to keep all the CDs. But then when he was older, when Kirby went to take a math class at the community college, and he'd never taken a formal math class at all. And before he left the first day, I said, oh yeah, I forgot to tell you. They show times three different ways. It might be an X like it is on a calculator, it might be a dot, or it might just be one numbers in parentheses. And he kind of rolled his eyes like, that's crazy. I mean, that's like explaining somebody, oh yeah, at the last minute, O-U-G-H might be cough or through or trough or, you know, yeah. So he went off with this irritating knowledge, and it didn't really help him. So the first week he was really baffled. It would be like someone who was a good musician, because he was fine with math. I mean, he could do percentages in his head. He could multiply two digits by two digits. I don't know how. He just could. But he never had to show his work. He'd never had to write it down. And if we had shown them their allowance algebra problem on paper, it wouldn't have meant anything to him. But, you know, John Lennon never could read music, and Paul McCartney learned in his 40s. So it's not that he didn't know anything about math, the concepts or how to do it or what it was good for. He didn't read that music. So he went to the class, and the first week Keith and I tried to help him, and that just irritated him. And I suppose there was probably an element of, yeah, if you had told me this when I was little, I wouldn't have to be asking now. You know, he wasn't mad at us, but just when you're frustrated, you know, you look out for what you're frustrated about. But then he asked other friends of his that he didn't have any emotional history with. They helped him a little bit, but by the third week he had it. It's like, okay, I can read music now, I can read this notation, I know what you're talking about. And the teacher liked him and he did well. It was a regular size class, 30 people or so, 25, 30. And by the end of that semester, he had the highest test grade in the class and the second highest grade. So it didn't hurt him in the long run that he didn't know the notation. 18. Maybe 19, but I think 18. This is a question about deschooling.
And for us to get it. And the book said take 3 months off. How much time do you take off for unschooling to learn how to unschool?
Oh, the question's about deschooling. So it's how much time would you take off so that you can cleanse your system so that you can start to unschool? Okay, the rule of thumb on kids, I didn't make this up. This is what people were saying when I came along years ago, is 1 month for every year you were in school. That's the recipe. And they mean fallow field. They don't mean just kind of don't do work. They mean leave it alone. Have it be like a Saturday with no homework. And so if a kid was in school up through third grade, that would be kindergarten plus 3, so 4 months. 4 months of no expectations. Just let him hang out. Pardon me? Oh, plus preschool. Yeah, that makes sense. And for unschooling, I say plus any time you did school at home. So for any years that you were homeschooling, but you had assignments and homework and all of the tests and stuff, that counts for school. Because you're not going to get over the expectation that you can only